From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable. It's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Midnight Movie Cowboys. I am Hunter Dusing in Dallas, Texas, and joining me in the Rocky Mountain High of Colorado is Mr. John Gray. Say hello, John.
Hello.
And joining us in Massachusetts, Boston, or are you in Boston or Florida now?
I'm in Florida now.
Oh, you're in Florida. I'm sorry. I'm used to you being, you're in Florida.
But I'll always be a mass hole.
Yeah, I was going to say, mass hole, but now he's a Florida man. Garen Nagosian.
Hey, how you doing?
Yeah, Mike Barron wrote a comic about you.
Yes.
Yes.
A Florida man.
Actually, I just came down here because basically it was like, I got to, now that Biden's president, you got to get away from, any northern Democrat city and just go down here with DeSantis, who's awesome.
Well, yeah, right. I'm living under Greg Abbott. You're living under DeSantis. Like, we're basically living in the rogue states of America right now.
Yep.
DeSantis could be president in 4 years.
He's getting he's getting a lot of hype there, a lot of buzz. He
could be the guy. I think they'd go with a former governor next time around.
Yeah. Although, hopefully he has better luck than Jeb.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Jeb was low energy.
He was low energy. Not high energy like Ron.
Yep.
Ron's got that Mar-a-Lago energy.
Yep.
Jeb Bush ever go to Mar-a-Lago? I think not.
Yeah, Jeb Bush doesn't even look like he lives in Florida. You ever notice that? He's very pale. It's flat.
Like his brother George, he's a carpetbagger. That's why. They're all from Connecticut or something.
Yeah, at least George was always in shape.
Yeah.
George looked like he was getting a tan or whatever.
That's because he was. Jeb was punching cattle, down at his ranch.
Jeb looks like he's being cucked 100% of the time.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. He is pure 100% cuckiness.
Yeah. It's got that big cuck energy.
Yeah. it's like he always has that look on his face like he's watching Long Dong Silver plow his wife.
Oh, man. So, speaking of husband and wife, we are doing a film by a husband and wife team, Monster Hunter, directed by the best Paul Anderson, Paul W.S. Anderson.
Yeah, the real filmmaker.
Yes, and starring his hot wife, Mila Jovovich, and also starring Tony Jaa, T.I., the rapper, although he's Tip T.I. Harris here because he's acting. He's not rapping. So the rapper name has to be in quotes.
Isn't he canceled now?
Maybe.
He
might be
him...
canceled. What happened? What happened? Why was he
Did
canceled?
He ask for some girl's phone number and he got canceled?
Like, I guess him and his wife were molesting women or something, or feeding him drugs or something. It was something where I heard he's not in the new Ant-Man movie because I guess he's in the first movie. And basically because there's something where basically they're saying that they're his wife and him are sex trafficking or something like that. I don't know. Yeah. It's people I don't care about. Then I see a story about them and I half pay attention to because
yeah,
I
you
really
just gloss over.
Yeah. Yeah. When you say that, I feel like I saw something about him. If there being some problematic something because he was in a bunch of movies coming out. Let's see. I'm seeing some here.
And the sad thing is that Christopher Plummer's gone and can't replace him in those movies.
Well, that's the thing is Christopher Plummer's usually an improvement. And now that he's dead, he was better than Kevin Spacey. Come on. If you saw that trailer, Kevin Spacey's buried in age makeup and all the money in the world. And Christopher Plummer comes in and just does it without.
The studio forced Kevin Spacey on that movie, and then basically because Ridley Scott really wanted Christopher Plummer, but they're like, no, we want someone more bankable like Kevin Spacey. And then
he became unbankable.
Yeah.
But in this movie, we've also got, I think the only one I didn't mention that is a name worth mentioning is Ron Perlman.
And it feels like that they were just making fun of him the entire time in the movie.
So because this is a Paul W.S. Anderson joint, not always, but many times, he's kind of the main guy when it comes to video game movies. And this is based on a video game. I know John.
After Ooh Ball.
Yeah, but Paul W.S. Anderson's actually good, you know? Ooh Ball. Yeah. Uwe Ball's movies have. So when I was a kid, I saw Super Mario Brothers in the theater. And it was pretty readily apparent that it had, apart from the name and some outfits, had zero to do with Super Mario Brothers. But when I saw Mortal Kombat when I was a kid, I went, okay, this is a movie that understands the games. It gets it. These are people who have played the games and understand them. And that was Paul W.S. Anderson. And he was very young at the time. And when he did this, he did the Resident Evil movies. He did this movie. And he's a guy who I think really loves video games, and it comes through in his work. But have you played any Monster Hunter games, Garrow?
I have not. I know that the new one is free if you get PlayStation Plus on the PS5, but you know, it's impossible to find a PS5. So, yeah. You know,
yeah.
When I get a PS5, I'll maybe give it a try.
Yeah. Monster Hunter World, I think, which is on PS4 and will be is on PS5. That's kind of the big budget. That's the Monster Hunter game to get. That's a game I think you would really enjoy because it has this openness. You go do quests, and it's a game that the original one came out for the PS2, and it's a Capcom game. Capcom also did the Resident Evil games, and which Paul Anderson also did all those films. He produced all of them. He directed most of them. But this is their second most profitable franchise after Resident Evil. And he's been basically trying to get a Monster Hunter movie made for 10 years now. And this project finally came to fruition. But the original game was basically one of the early online console games. And what you would do, it took place in this kind of Japanese steampunk fantasy world where you would collect items and basically go slay these giant monsters, but you would do a lot of preparation. And it was a lot of questing, and you would get a lot of materials to craft weapons and armor. Like a lot of RPGs, you get hit points, you fight, and you up your character. In these games, you would only get upgrades through your equipment. You couldn't grind and just get better. And also, the monsters don't have hit points. You have to see how they're doing based on the way they react to you attacking them. So it's a game where you have to, you know, sort of hunt the creature, you know, figure out how to take it down and prepare and do it. And so it's a game that people, when they play it, they pour a lot of time into. It's a big time sink. But I thought this film did a good job of sort of depicting that. But John, why was this a movie you went to see in the theater? Because obviously the game's I know you're not a gamer at all, so you know what made you go see it?
Hold on. John played Hubert.
John, okay. Yeah, I played that many years ago on. It wasn't an Atari 2600 console. I think it was one of those knockoffs that you know basically played the games, but it wasn't called Atari 2600. I forget what it was called.
Yeah, it was ColecoVision.
No, it wasn't Coleco. Coleco was more advanced than Atari.
Yeah, it was.
Coleco's kind of where it cut off, I think, because there was Atari, and then for some reason their interface.
It wasn't Odyssey.
It wasn't Odyssey. No.
Okay.
What about that? Because it had its own screen, and I think my mother thought if I connected an Atari to the regular TV, it would kill the TV. Like, you know, because boomers always think that sort of thing. Mm. And but you know, it doesn't matter with the computer interface when it comes into a fucking tube TV. But then there was Intellivision, and then there was ColecoVision. ColecoVision was where it started to look like the arcade game. You know, because before that, it was just squares and blobs and primary colors.
You know what was the Rolls-Royce of the video game consoles was the Neo Geo, because it used actual arcade boards. So, but you had to pay through. Yeah, it was a big old console, and the games were super expensive. It was super expensive, but you got literally, like, you know, when you would play an arcade port on the Nintendo Entertainment System or the Super, even the Super Nintendo, you know, it was close, but not quite there compared to the arcade game. The Neo Geo was, it used an actual arcade board. You got the arcade experience at home, but it was a niche product because it was very expensive.
Well, now you can buy these like $200 video game things you build in your home.
Yeah.
That I guess just fold out and you can play different 80s arcade games.
You can get them at Walmart.
Have you already stocked your house with those?
No, my wife would probably murder me if I came home with one of those. Well, but
she's the smarter one of the two.
Yes, but I gotta say, a lot of those arcade games you can approximate the experience on your console. So, you know, I can play, you know, Sunset Riders or Samurai Showdown on my Switch and get the exact same console experience. So.
Right. But I went to see this because basically it was a monster movie with Tony Jaa and Mila Jovovich, and like some of their work in the past. And I was going to take my son to see it, and we're going to go. And at that time, I think it's still like this. You can only occupy the theaters maybe 25% to 30%. And it was playing at the local AMC, and I my wife decided she wanted to go just to get out of the house and go see a movie. And we got our seat, you know, reserved online and all that, and went in and saw it. And, you know, it was a day out at the movies, which has become rare in the last year, thanks to you know what. And
Obama. Yeah.
I know. Yes. Thanks, Obama.
Partially. Yeah, the Chinese flu.
So, but speaking of monsters, there was a logo at the beginning of this movie that surprised me, which was the Toho Studios logo.
Yeah, and it's definitely more of a Toho movie than all these kaiju movies that made by Americans, like in the Chinese company Legendary.
When I watched this, I thought I was watching. It felt like a mix between a Toho monster movie and a Hammer horror film. Or a Hammer fantasy movie like Pirates of Blood River or something, like, you know, it just it had that, like, the set, these locations and sets with colorful lighting and comic book looking characters with crazy
and
hair.
Also had the Chris Gans kind of effect.
Yeah.
Steampunk people doing martial arts and Ron Perlman in there for no reason whatsoever. And,
just to have
know,
him there.
Just to look at him and go, hey, you don't have to add makeup to the guy.
He looks like he walked out of that live-action Dragon Ball movie from, like, 15 years ago.
Yes.
That
James Wong did.
Yeah.
He sure did. In a good way.
He also he had the best move against the monsters. He, like, pissed on his hand and didn't wash it. He shook the monster's hand. I thought that was awesome. I also like it when the CGI Jason Priestley punched him in the face, you know?
And... When he shook the monster's hand and he called it Little Donnie, he said, "Do you like
that,
Little Donnie?"
Yeah, he said, "Hey, Little Donnie, monster!" You know, and the monster had like orange hair, and then he was like, "He was like, I'm eating my own feces." What do you think about that, Little Donnie?
Little Donnie.
That was a very effective scene, especially in 3D.
You didn't get to see it in IMAX like I did.
Oh my God, Ron Perlman eating his feces in IMAX? Man, I'll tell you, that Little Donnie moment would have been amazing.
It's amazing. So the movie opens with, like, a ship sailing on a sea of sand, which is straight out of the Monster Hunter games. And
it's like some shit out of an Elric novel or
something.
Yeah, like
it really
Michael
is.
Michael Moorcock books from the 60s.
It really is. And a monster shows up. Tony Jaa's on the ship. He gets flung from the ship, lands in the sand. Then we're in our world, basically. Now, this is something that is not in the games. The games all take place in the Monster Hunter world. But we meet a group of Army Rangers with Mila Jovovich as the leader, Artemis. We've got T.I. as Lincoln and a few other characters. And they are out in the desert. And basically, they're searching for a team that went missing. They go into this area with runes. There's a storm. And they are transported to the Monster Hunter world. This was something that you don't see in the Monster Hunter games, but actually, Paul Anderson got the idea for it because he was playing the games and he was looking for ideas for the script. And there was a Metal Gear Solid Peace Walker Monster Hunter crossover event where Metal Gear Solid characters with modern military equipment were fighting the Monster Hunter characters. And he went, aha, because he wanted a way for the character. He wanted an avatar for the player, basically a person from the real world to be in the Monster Hunter world with the Mila Jovovich character. And that was kind of the way he wrote it. So he took that Metal Gear Solid inspiration. So from a separate video game, to bring it in there. And, I thought that was pretty cool how he kind of brought in something from another series that Garrow and I are big fans of.
Yes.
And, Mila Jovovich, you know, she's in all of Paul Anderson's movies. What do you guys think of her? Because I think she kind of predates the Disney Mary Sue type person. And so she gets a pass for me from all that, because I think she's always been, you know, from early on in her career, she's always done these kind of cool action fantasy comic booky things and has done them really well. So I don't know. I don't know where you guys stand on the Mila.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with her.
Yeah, I've always liked her. I think, I think she's still super gorgeous. I mean, she's got that face that's just great, John.
Yeah,
I would say I guess I would consider myself a fan, even though I don't love any of her movies. But she's so enthusiastic about doing this type of film, and she's allowed to be like a tough action heroine, but she still is female.
Yeah,
like,
that's the
she's
thing.
She's still hot. She looks. She has like male appeal. She still has that.
I think the fact that she's being directed by her husband too, he definitely knows how to make her look cool and sexy in a way where it's not too far in one direction. Yeah. And
I have no problem with it. She did a Chinese action movie.
It was called The Rookies or The Rookie, and it's like it came out like 2 years ago, and it was I read the description on IMDb, and it looks like a ripoff of Triple X. Because if you don't have a lisping lead, that actually, you know, ups the macho quotient quite a bit, you know.
Well, and also not being directed by Rob Cohen.
Exactly.
That's
like
a big factor.
He's raping every woman in Hollywood, apparently, including his daughter or something.
Think that's his publicist just putting that out.
Oh, okay. He certainly raped moviegoers when they went to see Triple X and that stealth movie with Jessica Biel and Jamie Foxx.
Oh, man, I forgot all about that.
I saw it on video. It was so bad. It was boring.
Oh, man.
He's like the worst director in Hollywood, easily.
Mummy, yeah. He killed the Mummy franchise.
Yeah, he did. He destroyed the franchise.
He directed the third one. The third one.
The one where awful. CGI Jet Li's Mummy, you know?
Yep.
Yeah. Oh, God.
So speaking of martial arts guys, Tony Jaa is in this movie. And I've heard a lot of people complaining that Tony doesn't have enough to do in this film. And Tony's one of those guys, honestly, I haven't really kept up with his career because, you know, he kind of exploded onto the scene. He had Ong Bak, The Protector, or Tom Yong-goon, whichever version you watched. But... you know, he kind of went crazy on the set of Ong Bak 2, and it seemed like his career sort of lost steam. It lost momentum. And Ong Bak and The Protector were not very good movies, I don't think. They had great action, but the scripts were barely even there.
Yeah.
And I don't know what... I know you guys are much more cued into that, so I guess, John, what did you... What are some of your thoughts on Tony Jaa as a martial arts movie star before this movie?
In those early films, he doesn't have much acting ability. He doesn't have much screen presence. His fights are enjoyable, but incredibly repetitive. And if you've done martial arts, you can see how he's kind of lightening the power. I don't know what would be the word, you know, he's taking the power out of his kicks when he hits people and stuff. So they don't take a full brunt. like, there's a clip of Steven Crowder making fun of Atomic Blonde and the way they do that front kick that pushes the stuntman away or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, it has no power in real life. Well, Tony Joss started that move. Like, I first saw that in Ong Bak, I believe. It's like, it's a choreography trick. That's all it is. Mm-hmm. But what he did was, I don't think he had much acting ability. He did lose a lot of momentum when he flipped out on Ong Bak 2 and the movie has no ending. And even though the action in that film is really good.
Yeah, I remember when
it has a great look.
Well, when I finally saw it, I was like, this is way better than the first Ong Bak. You know, when I...
Yeah, he looks good doing... He was doing different styles like Hungar and, Chinese styles and everything. And he looks sharp doing it. He's not... You know, in his younger life, apparently was not a martial artist. He was actually like a gymnast and stuntman training to be a martial artist on screen.
He was like the Gymkhana guy, basically, is what you're
saying. But actually, that's a smarter approach, because when you get a real martial artist and put them on screen, they tend to tense up and they're not very expressive on screen when you turn the camera on. It takes a while to get them to loosen up for the camera. And one reason Bruce Lee looked so good was he was a cha-cha dancer. So he kind of understood dancing as expression. So when he would do his moves, he made them very, big for the camera, very expressive for the camera. And, his career, it was weird. Like, he'd get announced, he's going to do a Drunken Master movie with Jackie Chan as Sam the Seed, and he's going to play Wong Fei Hung, and you'd hear all these crazy projects. He's going to do this movie with Sammo Hung, he's going to do that movie with Donnie Yen, and then nothing would happen.
Yeah, nothing.
And then he would end up, in one of the SPL, the second SPL movie, which I think they call Killzone in our American
video. They call it Killzone here.
And it was kind of an overdone, watchable, but overdone action movie with a lot of CGI. It's like they're using CGI when we're sick of it, and we don't watch their movies to see CGI. We like to see real, bone-crunching stunt work and action. And but he was in that, and he was getting better at the whole acting thing. He was, I guess, having to work with a Hong Kong crew or a mainland Chinese crew, whoever's making Killzone. He's up in his game a bit, so he's actually getting better. And then he ended up in kind of a throwaway role. Basically, I'll spoil this for everybody, but he did Paradox, and he's killed halfway through the film. And it's like the big twist in the film. And it's a decent movie. It's worth watching.
So it's like executive decision with Steven Seagal.
Right. And his acting and screen presence is getting better. And I thought in this movie, it's the best acting he's done, because he can't rely on just doing Muay Thai every 10 minutes when the audience gets bored.
Well, Paul W.S. Anderson said that he said that Tony Jaa is extremely funny.
Yeah.
And he said, and you wouldn't know it watching his other movies.
Right.
And
he's much better in
this. He said he wanted to bring that out in this film. Garrow, what are your thoughts on Tony Jaa? I mean, you're a martial arts movie buff.
Well, I was actually one of the first people to see Ong Bak, because I saw it when it premiered at the Toronto Film Festival. And basically, you get kind of blown away by the action in it, but you go like, the story sucks. Yeah. Tony Jaa has no charisma whatsoever. And it was like, literally, it's like you wish they would cut out all the boring parts and just make it like a 45-minute stunt reel. And it would have been 5 stars. But like, I liked Ong Bak. It just, I didn't feel it was the revolution that a lot of people at film festivals
The Protector was the same way. Tom Yong-goon. It had some really cool moments, action scenes. But overall, the story was just, he's like, the elephant.
The Miramax edit is actually superior of The Protector.
I would buy that, because I'm sure whatever Harvey cut out is stuff that I didn't care about.
I watched it for the first time about a year ago with my son, and I actually enjoyed it, and I didn't care much for it before that. I'd watched a bootleg, of the Thai version, and I watched it, and I said, oh, this isn't bad English dub with all the boring stuff cut out. It's like, this is okay.
I was just going to say, did you feel that way about The Protector, when that came out, or... Because felt about the same.
I thought The Protector was okay. Again, it wasn't anything that I thought was great. Like, I thought the stuff coming out of Thailand, like, there was that other one that the director of Ong Bak made called Chocolate.
Yeah,
And it was, that's another one where I thought the action scenes were great, the story was garbage and all that. And I always felt like what was coming out of Indonesia, like with The Raid 2, and The Night Comes for Us. Now, those are movies that I thought were, like, were complete movies, whereas basically stuff like On Bach, The Protector, and Chocolate were basically just, like, you know, demo reels looking for a movie.
Well, and, like, and we had a VHS 2, which was three parts total garbage, but then the guy from The Raid did a segment in it that was just awesome, you know? Like, it was just amazing.
And like Tony Jaa, I actually think he's become a better actor. Like about 2 years ago, they had that movie come out where it was with him, the guy from The Raid, and Tiger Chen, called Triple Threat. It's called Triple Threat, and it has like Michael Jai White and who's the guy in all the movies?
Scott Atkins.
Michael Jai White is the villains. And he was good in that. He actually had good charisma in that.
Yeah. It took him a while, but he developed it 20 years later.
Yeah.
So in this movie, I really, you know, what did you guys think? Because Tony Jaa plays the Monster Hunter character in this movie, and he's thrown out into the desert sands. He sees Mila Jovovich, she and her ranger buddies come through the portal, and they get, you know, just wrecked by these monsters. And, you know, spoilers, skip ahead 15 seconds. Her entire team is wiped out. Even T.I. gets smoked. And Tony Jaa basically captures her. And, you know, they sort of have this back and forth where she tries to escape, and they get into these scraps, these fight scenes. And my impressions of the fights were, they're pretty good. Mila does some decent fighting. They're pretty good for a Hollywood fight scene, but they have those problems that a lot of Western movies have, where they love to cut on action. And so there's too much cutting. And maybe that was a necessity. Yeah. But, you know, they're not as bad as most Hollywood fight scenes. I thought it was actually much better than the majority of stuff you see coming out of Hollywood action movies where people are actually tussling. But Hollywood editors cannot, especially when your editor's name is Doobie, they can't help but cut on action every single time. So that was kind of my takeaway. But I think Tony is hilarious in the movie, and he and Mila Jovovich have great chemistry, and which is even more remarkable because they don't speak the same language. Even when Tony is talking in the film, in like the extras on the Blu-ray, or you can't really understand him very well. He doesn't speak English very well, but he and Mila do a great job of bouncing off each other without speaking the same language. It was kind of, as far as Hollywood action movies goes, it was one of the more memorable kind of buddy things I've seen in a movie in a long time. Garrow, what did you think about that?
Well, I mean, I thought he was very good in this movie. My main problem with this movie, though, after the opening, you know, with the boat on the sand, I just think everything with the whole army thing and like the giant spiders and all that, I absolutely hated that part of the movie. I thought it was like an alien ripoff, a bad alien ripoff.
And we know Paul Anderson loves Alien.
Yeah. And I just felt like at that point,
because he made
I was
Alien versus Predator.
Yes.
I felt like it was just so derivative and boring and just like, I was like, oh, this movie's going to suck. This might be Paul Thomas Anderson's worst. Not Paul Thomas Anderson. Paul Thomas Anderson.
Well, listen, Paul Thomas Anderson's best movie is worse than Paul W.S. Anderson's worst movie.
But I was like, that would be Magnolia.
Yeah. I would rather watch Soldier on repeat than watch Magnolia ever again.
Yeah. I mean, Magnolia's absolutely garbage. But, but then once you get past that, then the movie becomes fun. you know, and I actually found myself enjoying the movie more as it went on and as more bizarre and crazy it got, you know. It was like once it got out of trying to appeal to like American audiences, which I thought was the first like half of the movie was trying to do, and then when it was going for like, you know, Japan and trying to appeal to them, then I liked the movie more.
Yeah, Paul W. Anderson said that he picked the spider creatures out of the Monster Hunter universe for that sequence because they reminded him of Alien.
Yeah.
So, you know, there you go.
Yeah, it was, that was the worst part of the movie.
The I thought they had terrific chemistry. It kind of reminded me that a lot of movies these days, particularly of the Marvel universe kind, have a lot of actors and leads who have no chemistry whatsoever with each other on screen. And they're all spouting this pseudo Joss Whedon log, and it's really boring. And I thought the chemistry was great. They made a great team. I wasn't as bothered by that first half of the film, but it could have used something a little more original. The funny thing is, I read a review from the comic book writer Chuck Dixon had reviewed it, and he liked the first half and didn't care for the second half. So, you know, different strokes for different folks, I guess.
I
liked the Asian action stuff. Oh. Yeah, I didn't have much of a problem with it, but I thought the second half was better when it went more for the foreign entertainment. You know,
I agree. I didn't mind the military team, especially because that part happens pretty quick and they get wiped out pretty quick. And yeah. And Tony Jaa, once he comes in, the movie really gets going. And the thing about Paul W.S. Anderson is, you know, with people that make a lot of jokes about Scorsese calling Marvel movies theme park movies and stuff like that. And, but to me, his movies feel like a roller coaster usually, where he has characters in one place, next place, next place, next place, where we're going deeper and deeper into something that he telegraphs way ahead of time, whether it's like Alien versus Predator, we're going down into this temple in mm-hmm. Antarctica. Like, he gives us the path, and then we go on the path to the place. And he does that right in Resident Evil, where we go from the mansion to the hive, to within the hive, to back out of the hive. And in this movie, we have Mila Jovovich getting spit out in this, like, really awesome location work they did in Africa. Stunning. And she gets spit out into this alien landscape. And we see this tower with a storm over it in the distance. That's the location we have to get to. And we're running towards there. And that's just something you see in all of his movies, that it feels like we're on this ride to there. And the people, the military stuff, it's just like the first stage. And then we get to Tony and, you know, the fights they have. And then they have to take out Diabolos, one of the big monsters. Which is a pretty cool sequence, because, you know, they have to kill these monsters to get the crafting, to build the weapons, to fight the next monster, which is straight out of the video game. It's very cool.
Yeah.
The monsters, they look just like their video game counterparts. It's pretty cool. And the weaponry and everything, like, it's just straight out of it. They didn't take any liberties with it. It's pretty neat.
So why did he not direct the Dungeons and Dragons movie, since that seems to be up his alley?
I don't know. Maybe he doesn't like tabletop stuff. Maybe he's just
doesn't like role playing.
You know, he's
he
just
hates
he's,
the graph he's, paper and those dice, those funky dice.
He hates Tom Hanks. You know, mazes and monsters and stuff's for nerds.
Think England. Yeah,
Paul Thomas Anderson. He's kind of the OG like gamer Chad. You know. He's
yeah,
a gamer
yeah,
he's
and his Mila Jovovich. Yeah! You know. I don't think these other guys can be able to do that. You know?
No, like he's definitely the most Chad gamer out there. And like, you know, going way back, you know, I'm gonna keep saying that. Paul W.S. Anderson. He's, you know, gone way, he is the OG, like he's the first guy to make a decent video game movie with Mortal Kombat, you know.
Yeah.
Which I really enjoy. And, you know, he just, and he always is bringing in these f- film influences in a way that's organic to the game that he's trying to adapt. He's not trying to show you how smart he is.
This actually reminds me of something, Hunter, with yes. You know, they put out that teaser trailer of the new Mortal Kombat, and it's just kind of boring one-on-one CGI gore stuff that, you know, some people are pretending to be excited about.
Yeah.
But I remember back when Paul W.S. Anderson's movie was when the trailers were in theaters, people went nuts.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember Caro calling me, like, he saw it opening day, and he said that in the theater, like a half hour before it started, like, people in the crowd were just shouting, Mortal Kombat! Like,
yep.
People were so enthusiastic for that movie to open, and I don't sense any celebratory feeling for this new one or really anything else.
I gotta tell you, I haven't seen the teaser for it, and I wasn't in any hurry because the buzz was only around the violence.
Yeah.
And I went, if the buzz is only around the violence, then it just has one ingredient that was missing from his film. His film was aimed at the
kids.
Exact right audience.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was able to see it. And
right.
If it had been a rated R movie, I would not have been able to see it. But I was exactly the audience he was aiming for. And the movie was just edgy enough to where I could see it. And it also captured the spirit of those games. And to be honest, okay, Mortal Kombat in the arcade was a very violent game. But a lot of people, myself included, played it at home on ports for the Super Nintendo, for the Sega Genesis, and for the Nintendo Game Boy. Okay. The Super Nintendo and the Game Boy ports had very little blood and guts. They were very compromised. They took a lot of the violence out. So when I would go over to friends' houses and we would rent Mortal Kombat for the Super Nintendo, when you would punch people in the face in the arcade game, blood would stream out. In the Super Nintendo version, just kind of a sweaty looking liquid would fly out. And on the Sega Genesis version, there was a code you could enter. The Genesis version was the kind of based version because it had all the violence included. But I think you had to put in a code. I could be wrong. Somebody, I'm sure Positively Wolfie will message me and tell me whether or not that's correct. But and it's out of love, of course. We love Positively Wolfie. Go listen to it on iTunes. Great show about allegedly real news. Very good. Love it. But a lot of kids played versions of Mortal Kombat, and I had it on the Game Boy, which was a terrible port, but it was all I had. And there was no blood or guts. There was, you know, just a little bit of charred burning here and there. Getting it in a PG-13 form with no explicit gore was fine, because that's what most of us were used to.
Plus, it wouldn't have made a dime if it were an R-rated movie.
No, and like you see these idiots on the internet going, "Oh my gosh, you know, it has gore. Like, why was that such a hard thing to include in the original? Because that was stupid." You know?
Yeah, because you got to bring in families, you got to bring in kids, you know,
and
you
kids
have to see the stuff.
And the new one doesn't need to make money because it's going right to HBO Max, so it does
right.
It doesn't need to make money right now, so they can put whatever they want. They can put hardcore pornography into it; it wouldn't matter,
right?
Yeah. So, you know, and I know that the new Mortal Kombat games are extremely violent with the fatalities and all that.
They must be plugging into that, because what I saw in the trailer was just like, other than Hiroyuki Sanada is in it, it's good. It's always nice to see him get a role, even when he's in garbage like this. It's like, you know, it's cool to see him, possibly the most successful Japanese actor of all time.
Yeah. No, I think if you look at like Mortal Kombat fatality compilations on YouTube, they have quite a bit of views.
Right.
So that gives you an idea of what they're tapping into.
But you know, movies are different. Movies are different. You got to go different with a movie. You got to have scope and scale and appeal to people who don't play video games, and that's what these video game junkies don't understand.
Yeah, but even back then, you know, people act like you played Mortal Kombat for the blood and guts. Yes, that's what got us in the door, but most of us spent most of our time playing Mortal Kombat at home, and Mortal Kombat at home, like the meme, was not Mortal Kombat in the arcade. It was was much, much less gory, much less violent, because a lot of parents weren't going to buy the most violent game in the world for their kid, so they toned down the gore and violence. The Genesis version was kind of the exception. But yeah. So, you know, Anderson understood, but he understood the spirit of those games because they were similar to Enter the Dragon. And, you know, so he kind of made an Enter the Dragon like movie with those, with those fantasy characters from those games.
Yes, he did. And I really thought Robin Chow was going to have more of a career than he
Me
did.
Me too.
Did not know what happened there.
Man, yeah, I saw him. So Anderson produced an adaptation of Dead or Alive, which is this fighting game series from Japan, which is, you know, Mortal Kombat is famous for blood and guts. Dead or Alive was famous for, like, you know, girls with huge boobs.
That was the one Yun Kuei directed, right?
Yes. Corey Yun directed it. Yeah. So they did a movie out of that with, like, tons of hot girls in it. But Robin Shaw was in that.
God, I forgot he was in it. Yeah. I remember King Kasugi was in it, and a lot of good-looking women. And that's kind of, and the fights were basically Corey Yun Kuei's greatest hits. He was, like, remaking fights from Ninja in the Dragon's Den.
Yeah.
Some of his other films. And it's fun. I think I got it at Big Lots for like $2.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a blast. I mean, it's kind of just fun background stuff to play.
It has something
it's missing from movies, hot girls.
Yeah. Absolutely. And it's also an Enter the Dragon remake with everybody goes to an island to fight. But I remember Robin Shaw was in that, and that was the first time I'd seen him since, like, Beverly Hills Ninja.
Yeah. Right.
Or actually, did Mortal Kombat Annihilation kill his career?
I don't know if that would kill it.
Yeah.
It just seems like he didn't do anything. And I thought, well, if they're going to do a Shang-Chi Master Kung Fu movie, you know, in 97, 98, because of Blade, I was like, well, get Robin Shaw. What are they thinking? And it's like, nope, nothing happened.
Garo, do you know what happened to Robin Shaw?
I think what happened is basically, I think Mortal Kombat 2 happened, I think, to be perfectly honest. I mean, that was such a piece of shit. You know?
Yeah. Oh,
and
Hollywood didn't do that one.
No. And I think what happens is that basically it's like, I think if Mortal Kombat 2 was a hit, which it wasn't, it kind of bombed because it sucked. I think what would happen is it'd be like, oh, he's been in two successful movies, we got to do something with him. And but when you're just have one successful movie and you're not white, they tend to be like, you know, well, let's just wait and see what someone else does with him, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of what happened. In I think Mortal Kombat 2 being so horrible kind of killed any momentum he had.
It killed everybody's career in that film. Yeah. I don't think anybody there went on anything except for a stuntman named Tony Jaa.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
He worked on the film as a stuntman. He was one of the stunt fighters.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
Yeah, because they filmed it in Thailand.
The smartest person in that was Christopher Lambert, who didn't come back for the second one.
Yeah.
He was
I don't think
terrible.
The chick from Happy Gilmore came back either.
No, I don't know.
Not Happy Gilmore, Billy Madison. Billy Madison.
Yeah. Bridget Wilson was her name?
Yeah, she was Sonya Blade. And she didn't come back for this. I think Robin was the only guy who came back. And I remember I had a friend who went, his parents took him to see it in the theater because we were that young when it came out. And his parents got up and they were like, we're leaving. This movie sucks. And I know he felt so embarrassed and humiliated because he wanted to go see this movie, and his parents were like, this movie's garbage. We're leaving.
Like, Bob, the first one was good. I don't know what happened.
And this is compared to my poor father, who suffered through Super Mario Brothers with a smile, you know, just acted like he had a great time, even though I know he didn't. I know my dad was sitting there going, I love Bob Hoskins, but this movie sucks. I love Dennis Hopper, but this movie sucks. But my son wants to be here. So I'm not. He did not say a. He never said a negative word about Super Mario Brothers.
But meanwhile, he was secretly analyzing it as the Japanese corrupting the youth.
My dad. Actually, that's
Italian probably, stereotypes.
You know what? That's probably the movie that made my dad like super against you. You know, back this was back when they called video games Nintendo.
Mm-hmm.
This is what made him against Nintendo. You know, he was like my
the
son,
wise man, because he was totally right.
He's like this game, this Japanese foreign influence is corrupting my son. Yeah. He likes this stupid That's movie totally... where Dennis Hopper is screaming about Goombas.
And I didn't go see it because I felt that was a racial slur towards
yes.
me.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles was about.
Mm. Which
it's about the Japanese corrupting youth because they're all like in that arcade playing video games with the foot plant.
That's true.
In control of everything behind the scenes.
The Japanese, it's like Sam Rockwell selling cigarettes to the kids, and the Japanese guy's like, "Go play."
We see what's going on. Come on, only Golden Harvest would produce a movie like that. The producers of Duel to the Death.
Also about Robin Chow, there was one movie he did between Mortal Kombat and Mortal Kombat Annihilation that I think also hurt his career.
Mm-hmm.
Beverly Hills Ninja.
Yeah. I think I brought that up earlier. I was like, yeah, Beverly Hills Ninja, right? And that was a movie when I was a kid, I loved it. So, but it was not a hit. I think it.
No, it wasn't.
It didn't do
That's
well.
That's a Chris Farley movie people forgot.
Yeah, but when I was a kid, I had that on VHS. I loved Beverly Hills Ninja.
Of course you did.
Yeah.
You were Mr. VHS shelf.
I was I was like in third grade. I mean, come on. Right. You know, it was made for me.
Yeah, Beverly Hills Ninja and Tommy Boy and Mortal Kombat.
I had Beverly Hills Ninja. I had Tommy Boy. I had
Black Sheep?
No, I didn't have Black Sheep. That one I recognized was not very good. I had Billy Madison.
The Coneheads.
I had Ferris Bueller's Day Off. And I think I had
Night at the Roxbury.
You know what? I think I did have Night at the Roxbury.
Did you have The Ladies' Man?
No, I didn't have. I never saw that one. I never saw The Ladies' Man.
Did you have Pat? It's Pat?
No, never saw It's Pat. Managed to avoid that one. What did I have? I had Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, I'm pretty sure.
Mm-hmm. Secret of the Ooze? Do you have that?
I think so.
I got that on Blu-ray at Dollar Tree.
Yeah, I've got all those on Blu-ray now, of course. I've got Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 3 on Blu-ray.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
What's sad is Lau Kar-Wong worked on that.
Oh, really? He did?
Yeah, he worked on the...
Was he there, like, on the laugh track? Man, that movie shot like a sitcom. It's terrible.
It is a bad film. It's no martial arts, no action.
No, and, like, Jim Henson wouldn't even work on it. You know, studio...
Yeah, Lau Kar-Lung said he worked on that, and that's all he needed for working on American movies. That's all he needed.
He's like, no,
that's what he said in an interview. It's
well, like,
rest in peace, sir.
In the Blu-ray for Monster Hunter, Tony Jaa commented that working on American films is very different. He didn't say anything negative, but he said it's very different than working on Eastern films. But it seemed like he and Mila had a great time working together. Just like all the stuff with them, like bit chocolate,
just
lots of fun. Lots of good stuff. And I loved the location work that they got.
If you think about it though, they were both ESL, you know, English, second language.
That's
She's
true.
Russian and he's Thai. So it's like, you know, it was probably, that maybe that's one reason the on-screen chemistry happened is because they had to work like that.
Yeah, look at John bringing in his education terms. Yes. but what did you guys think of the actual monster fights in the movie with like Diablos and I forget the big dragon's name.
Michelle Obama.
Rathalos, the big dragon character. What'd you guys think of the monster stuff in this movie? Because we talked a little bit about the martial arts. What about the actual monster fights? Garrow, what'd you think?
I thought they were a lot of fun. It's like, that's when the movie started to take off for me, you know, when it started to get like real ludicrous and over the top and fun, you know, it was that's what I felt the whole movie should have been, you know, and it makes me hope that there's a sequel so they don't have to have the boring half hour of alien ripoff shit and can actually just go in and do the goofy fun, you know, monster fighting and all that. But I don't think there's going to be a sequel.
We're ripping out this spider's stinger and like putting it on an arrow and like wrapping its guts around to do it. It's so cool.
But yeah, it was fun. It was fun. Once it got to the big monster fighting, it was a blast. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, and I loved all the stuff with them like preparing and getting ready and just like taking parts and stringing it together. I mean, that's stuff that's straight out of the game. It's, the big satisfaction of the game is that you put this work into, you find out what this monster is, what its weaknesses are, and you put time into like getting your stuff together and figuring out your strategy before you go fight, you know.
Yeah, it's kind of like Reign of Fire, if Reign of Fire was like action, monster action for most of the movie instead of like 8 minutes.
Yeah, actually, I was talking to Mike Malloy while I was watching this. I was taking a quick break and I mentioned I was watching this movie and I said, the closest thing I can compare it to is Reign of Fire.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I said, that's the movie it reminds me the most of. Yeah, it's very much, cause Reign of Fire, it's like these people getting ready to go fight these dragons and these dragons are like virtually invincible.
Yeah.
You know, and, it definitely, it's a movie that surprises you because there are characters that you get really invested in that movie who get killed like nothing, you know,
right.
like they just get tail whip, boom, dead, nothing. That's
and
it.
It's also a wonky, these are wonky concepts to get across to an audience, you know, a general audience. It's not going to throw off people who grew up like reading or watching sci-fi stuff or playing video games
like
that.
Like us.
Yeah, like, but getting this stuff across to like a general audience and somehow making that work, which I think in Reign of Fire's case is because Matthew McConaughey's chewing the scenery is like a basically Sergeant Rock, and in this movie you get it across by, you know, a charismatic cast, and I think it works. I think this did pretty decently considering the pandemic movie going experience.
Yeah, Garrow, you were saying you don't think it's going to get a sequel.
Yeah, I don't think it made enough money. I think even with the pandemic, it didn't. Like, I remember it opened. Like, I think it kind of bombed in China because it opened up there, and there was some like throwaway joke that Chinese people found were offended by, so they pulled it from theaters and cut it out. And then when it came back, no one went to go see it, so it lost all that Chinese money.
So there's this scene in the movie where, if you look at the deleted scenes on the Blu-ray, there's this scene where the Australian guy and the Chinese guy are telling jokes, and there's a few cut scenes. It's just them telling jokes. And that scene is not included in anywhere on the Blu-ray, but there's the scene where the punchline is, I got these Chinese, and he's talking about his knees. It's not even like, it's not even anything, but people made a big deal out of it when it came
out. They Dr. Seussed it. And
yeah,
China.
Absolutely. Oh, they made this huge deal out of that joke, and it wasn't even anything. It was just kind of a pun with knees and being, I'm Chinese, you know?
Yeah.
It's just silly. And people made this huge deal out of it.
Yeah. It killed the momentum for it in China, where it would have made a lot of money. Right. Like it only made $28 million worldwide. Yeah. And you know the movie cost way more than
it costs, like $60 million, I think.
Yeah. So, I mean, this movie lost money. That's why I don't think there'll be a sequel.
I just wonder if pandemic will give it some wiggle room, but I don't know. Maybe not.
Probably not, because they'll be like, oh, nobody went to see it, so you can't really make a sequel to a movie nobody saw. Mm-hmm. You know, they can't use the Norm MacDonald excuse. $28 million. You know how much money that is?
Yeah. So basically, it's I honestly feel that you're not going to get a sequel. It, like, this movie had to make at least $60 million worldwide for them to consider a sequel.
Which is too bad because it's way fun. I love the cat who cooks steak. And
yeah, that was great. very funny visual.
Oh man, I laughed out loud when the cat's like putting little herbs going meow. <on the steak. laughs> And when you play the games, you have these little cat characters who kind of help you out fighting and stuff. So there's this race of cat people in the games that do stuff for you, and that's kind of, and if you play Monster Hunter World, there's a cat character who literally is carving steak and setting it on fire. But so yeah, that was pretty cool. And all the different weapons they have, like the big great sword Tony Jaa's flipping around, and Mila Jovovich has those daggers, and you know, Ron yeah. Perlman's like bursting fire, and there's those like those grappling hooks, which kind of made me wonder if Attack on Titan took any inspiration from Monster Hunter the games. Any of you ever seen Attack on Titan?
I know what it is, but I haven't seen it.
Really? I mean, Attack on Titan is different enough to where you could say it's totally original, but it has these giant monsters called Titans that are really freaky looking, attacking these cities that people are walled up in. You know, they use these grappling hooks to kind of fly through the air and take them out. But if the Titans get you, they grab you and bite your head off.
Well, I guess I could say that was probably taken from Empire Strikes Back, how they take down those big walking tank things.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Although the anime Attack on Titan is cool, the live action movies are garbage, terrible. Do not.
Is it Japanese?
Yeah.
Is it from Japan?
Yes.
Oh, that's why.
Yeah, I think who directed the movies?
They cannot do live action. I think, was it like the Shin Godzilla guy, or was it somebody's directed a kaiju recently or something?
The Shin Godzilla guy was an anime guy. No,
oh, okay.
These were directed by Shinji Higuchi. Did the live action ones? I don't know who he is. It was okay. I think Toei produced them.
Oh, okay.
He worked as special effects on the Gamera film Shusuke Kaneko did, so that's his
okay.
claim to fame. No, I thought they were directed by like Takashi Miike or something, but no, they're just
nah. He would have had like the giant creatures like, you know, fisting each other, or something. or you know, the main character is a transvestite, so you
yes.
know, so they play at all the film festivals and. You know, in U.S. and Canada, you know.
Yes. It's another work of genius by Miike.
Or some scene where somebody just vomited for 10 minutes. You know, that there. People were so desperate to have a new cult director they could idolize. It's so weird.
Yeah, Miike was... they were a little too quick with him because he.
It's like, come on! It like somebody who's consistent. Don't
yeah.
like somebody just because they make 30 friggin' movies a year and maybe one is watchable.
Yeah, Miike has a great movie Once in a Blue Moon. You know,
yeah,
you'll get a.
I've liked some of his stuff, but God, for the most part, it's garbage.
Yeah, no, like again, every now and then you'll get a 13 Assassins.
Yeah,
which is
every now
dope. Then. You know, so good, and every now and then you'll get an audition or. You know, something weird, genuinely weird, like Ichi the Killer. But yeah, he's
yeah.
most. I remember when like
Garo loves Ichi the Killer.
Yeah,
oh,
he's got the barf bag.
I hated that movie. I saw it at the when it premiered at Toronto Film Festival, and I was just like, that was awful. me and my friend walked out of it like, really, people like that? It's terrible.
Yeah, one of the things that's hilarious about that movie is, did you ever play Tekken, Garo?
Yeah, I've played it a couple of times, but not a long time.
So there's this move Jin Kazama has where he lifts his leg up in the air and he brings it down.
Yep.
Really hard, and it comes down on the head of your opponent and knocks him to the ground. Mm-hmm. And when you see Ichi in the game, he's always playing Tekken, and he's playing as Jin Kazama. And then in the movie, whenever he kills someone, he does that move to people, but he's got the blade on his heel, so it like cuts them in half. I was going, he's doing Tekken moves when he's killing, you know, people.
I remember at Toronto, I saw they showed a Miike film called Gozu. I don't know if any of you.
Oh yeah, I never saw it, but yeah, I
haven't seen
Gozu.
It's like Gozu is like fucking boring for like most of the movie.
Well, that's
it's
most
like
of his movies. Yeah,
terrible. But then it has this admittedly great, weird, fucking crazy ass ending. But it's like, I don't want to sit through 2 hours of boredom just for a decent end, you know, a crazy ending. You know, can't you just make something like interesting and then give the crazy ending and then it's much more enjoyable?
Well, you know what movie he did that was like that was Dead or Alive? Did you see that one?
Yeah, but I actually thought Dead or Alive better than I like Gozu.
Yeah, because Dead or Alive, the opening is bonkers, crazy,
yep,
and then the movie's really boring, and then it has this crazy ending that's amazing. So it's, you know, you have a good beginning and ending, but just I remember all the stuff in between was, you know, I was going, when is this going to get going again? But Dead or Alive 2, I thought, was pretty consistently good throughout. And then Dead or Alive 3, I thought was just a complete piece of garbage. There was nothing good in that. But
yeah, I never saw Dead or Alive 3.
No, don't bother.
I could live a good life never seeing a Takashi Miike movie. I'm just saying, it's it's really not necessary. It's kind of like he got big at that time when there would always be a buzz over these potential cult movies at the Toronto Film Festival or wherever. And, you know, what does that mean in the end? Does it mean you're actually getting good movies or you're just getting stuff that really blew away the Canadians that year, you know?
Yeah, it was, you know, I would go to the Toronto Film Festival and like, I see a handful of movies that I was like, okay, that was really good. But for the most part, it was like, and that wasn't very good, or that's kind of boring, and that's really pretentious, you know. But there were like a handful every year that were actually good.
They were trying to recapture that Reservoir Dogs magic because they screened that there, and it was a big sensation. I think it was one of the first places it was screened where it got a huge reaction.
So they just throw spaghetti at the wall and just try to find some.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of
anything
a lot
weird
of crap.
And you know.
That's the one thing you don't know. When you go to a film festival, like you think, oh, it's a film festival. It's going to, every movie's going to be good. No.
No.
About more than 50% of the movies are absolute fucking garbage. And the only reason they're there is because the director is friendly with the programmers.
Mm-hmm. No, that's true.
Or it's got a major star in it and that'll get people to buy tickets to go see it because it's still a business. So, you know, if a big star is in a shitty movie, they're going to book the shitty movie.
It doesn't even have to be a big star. It just has to be someone people have heard of, you know?
Yeah. Let me put it this way. If there's a movie with no stars in it and a movie with Jamie Farr in it that's like bad and a good movie with no stars, they'll pick the bad movie with Jamie Farr instead of the good movie with no stars. That's film festivals for you.
Absolutely. It's 100% correct.
As I said in the Mallrats episode, 31 and Yoga Hosers played Sundance.
Yes.
Yeah, that's the end of film festivals. That's all you need to know.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I was listening to some of Rob Zombie's new album, and you know, he just needs to stick to making music. You know, just good. Just
so
good.
Did it rock, Hunter? Did it rock?
It was just. It's the exact kind of thing he should be doing. It's just big.
Did
guitars.
You do push-ups to it?
Yes.
How many?
It was just how many? Did you do push-ups? How many? No, but it's the exact kind of, you know, Al Jourgensen with B movie samples. That's all he needs to do. He does not.
You say Al,
all he is.
Olsen.
No, Al Jourgensen, like Ministry.
So he's in blackface, really? And he's like singing House of a Thousand Corpses.
He's probably done it. He's probably done it.
You know,
Jack's mammy.
You know what I've been listening to lately? I actually didn't listen to it because Stewart said it was bad. I listened to the newest Darkness album, Easter Is Cancelled.
Oh, yeah.
And
And I can say I kind of agree with Stewart on it, but there are still some good tracks on it. But there's a lot of really slow shit on there. You're like, why is this on the album? And it's a good chunk of the album. But then there's some like really, really good tracks on it. I think there's like three or four like decent to really good tracks on it. But it's definitely their most disappointing album since their second.
Yeah, I've,
so it's
I've
their,
heard
it's
it.
Their Eddie Trunk album.
Yes.
Yeah.
I've, that's what it sounds like.
The Darkness, even if they put out a bad record, there's bound to be a few decent things on there.
Yeah, like the opening track, Rock and Roll Deserves to Die, is really good. I really like that. And then there are a couple of other ones that are actually really good. But but like I said, it's a very uneven album. It has more in common with their second album than it does any of their other albums.
Oh, unfortunate.
That's bad.
Yeah.
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 Although I think I do like it a little bit better than their second album.
Well, you know, their second album is pretty bad, so.
Yeah. Oof. And I was kind of, because I was kind of on a Darkness kick, so I started watching all their music videos, and I got to the video for the song Girlfriend from the second album, and I'm like, this is the lowest point ever for the Darkness. It is a horrible video for
it
a
It killed
horrible
their momentum. I think it yeah. actually killed their career. Mm-hmm. Because they were the biggest band in England, or in the UK, I believe, and they were huge in Europe. That they were kind of like a big cult band in the States. They were about to break mainstream. That second album came out, it was over.
Yeah, if their third album was their second album, I think things would have been much different.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah.
Well, do you guys want to wrap up Monster Hunter? What did you guys kind of think overall? What were your sort of takeaways? You know, final thoughts, Garrow, we'll go with you first.
Thought it was a fun film. It was under 2 hours, which I always appreciate.
Me too.
And I just didn't like the first like half hour. You know, I thought it was too derivative. I thought it wasn't fun. And then once it broke free from that, a lot of fun. One, because I'm not a huge, you know, fan of, you know, Paul W.S. Anderson. Like, I love the first Mortal Kombat. I don't really care for the Resident Evil movies, except for, I think it's Regeneration, which is the one that opens in Japan.
I think that's Afterlife.
It may be Afterlife, yeah.
I haven't seen that one.
Yeah,
Afterlife is the best one, in my opinion.
Yeah. Okay. That one is the only one I'll actually say of the Resident Evil movies is a good movie. And that one I actually like. You know, and I didn't care much for his Three Musketeers movie. I never saw Pompeii, you know, so I'm kind of iffy on him. Like, I remember seeing it.
Or maybe it's Retribution. It's Retribution, the one, maybe. I can't. It's the one where they go into, like, the base where it's, they recreate all this stuff from the past.
No, that's the one after.
Okay,
the one.
Okay. Afterlife is the one I was thinking of, so I was right. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because I didn't care much for Retribution. Wait, hold on. 2012 was Retribution. That one I didn't care for. Okay. Afterlife, 2010.
Afterlife is the best one, hands down.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And
did that have the great ad where it looked like a cosmetic ad?
No, that was Resident Evil Apocalypse.
Oh, God, how many of these are there?
There's Resident Evil, Resident Evil Apocalypse, Resident Evil Extinction, Resident Evil Afterlife, Resident Evil Retribution, and Resident Evil The Final Chapter. So.
What about Resident Evil Bar Mitzvah?
Oh, that was the canon.
Resident Evil Communion. Where is that? Confirmation.
Is that the one where they, is Resident Evil Communion the one where they fight the aliens that gave him anal probes?
I think so.
With yes. Christopher Walken?
Yeah,
in the
they got him for a cameo. It was easy.
But I'm not like a huge Paul W.S. Anderson fan, but I admit he's made some good movies, and I think this is probably on the tier of like into his good movies. And on a scale from 1 to 10, I'd give this a 6. I enjoyed it. I had problems with the beginning, but I enjoyed most of it, and I felt if they ever did get a sequel, that I think it would be probably a more enjoyable movie and actually better than the first one. You know, but as long as Paul S.W.S. Anderson made it, not the guy who made the second Mortal Kombat.
Yes. John, what about you? What would you give? What was your final thoughts on Monster Hunter?
For me, it was just a fun popcorn movie to see with the family that wasn't some Disney thing with Broadway shit songs in it and stuff. But... So, you know, on that level, I was glad I didn't have to sit through something like that. And it was something I actually wanted to see. And my son's a big Tony Jaa fan because those early movies, as mediocre as we think they are, they're very simple. And you can show them to kids and kids can enjoy them because they don't have to think about them very much. You know?
Elephant so, gets kidnapped, must see.
Yeah, exactly. They're very simple. And they're basically children's films with graphic violence and junkies shooting heroin.
So what you're saying is The Protector is a better live-action Dumbo movie than the Tim Burton one.
Yes, yes, it is. I think Disney should have just bought it and marketed it. It would have saved them a lot of money, I think. So I'll give it like a 6.5. It was a lot of fun for just as a family movie day or a family movie afternoon.
I'm probably overrating it a bit, but I'm giving it an 8. I really thought it was a fun, big monsters, comic book action, great locations, great fighting, great... props. And as an adaptation of a video game, I think it's really good. And I think Paul W.S. Anderson is the only guy him and Christoph Gans are the only directors making video game adaptations who really get them because they actually play them and enjoy them. And this movie's a perfect example of that. Even if you're a purist and you don't like the military angle, I think it still works bringing it all in and, I enjoyed it immensely. So yeah. Garo, where can we watch your stuff?
Well, Dangerous People is on Tubi. Yay!
Or not, so not Tubi.
Or yes, but it is Tubi. Okay. So you can watch it there. It's on DVD and Blu-ray, and you can hear Hunter on the commentary track. So it's worth getting for that if you're a big Hunter fan. And then I'm on Facebook. I'm trying to get banned from Twitter, but they haven't banned me yet. I'm hoping soon, so I don't have to use it anymore.
I'll start reporting your tweets just to help.
Yes, thank you. But yeah, I'm on there. You know, my name is very easy to spell. So just, you know, type it into Facebook or type it into Twitter and you'll find me. Actually, I don't think you'll find me on Twitter. I don't think I have my actual name on there. So, yeah, fuck Twitter. But you can get me on Facebook. And other than that, yeah, that's it. That's all I'm doing.
Word. John, you know, we've got some stuff from Stu's Views. You know, he talked about the El Duce tapes.
That's right.
Which I went out and bought after hearing. I was not going to buy the El Duce tapes because I don't want to watch Such Darkness. And then,
but then you remembered your name is Mr. Arrowshell.
Yes. And also Stu talked about how dark and depraved they were. And I went, okay, I got to get these for the archive. So, you know, I bought them for the reason I thought I wasn't going to buy them. But actually, it's because, you know, just mentor stuff is that gets a decent release is so few and far between.
Right.
That's why I really got it. And shout out to April Jones. Her film was The Kings of Sleaze. Was that it? Kings of Sleaze?
Yeah, I think it was Kings of Sleaze, the Mentors documentary.
Fantastic Mentors doc. Go watch it. Go look it up. I don't know where to watch it, but it's out there. April Jones, cool.
Yeah, hunt it down. It's totally worth watching.
Yeah, and she was on our show talking about it, and so yeah,
our infamous 6-hour episode about the mentors.
Yeah, we had Steve Roy. We had a Sicky Wife Beater on. Yeah, good times, Steve Roy. Yeah, I didn't get to talk to him, but Stu did. So
right,
cool, good times. All right. Well, guys, I think that's it for this week. Anything else you want to add?
No. Just check out the stuff we mention and promo. You know, drop little hints every now and then. And, you know, we'll try to get a show out this year. We plan on having a show out as much as possible, which for us would be like maybe once a week. We can maintain this momentum.
Yes, let's just keep it going. All right, guys. Well, that's it. I'm going to say adios.
I'll say that's about all. Peace out.
Peace out.
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. For more information, go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com. For feedback, comments, or show suggestions, go to midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like what you hear? Head on over to iTunes and leave us a review. Hear us on Stitcher Radio. Head over to stitcher.com and download the app. Want to help the show out? Head on over to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Find us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Like us on Facebook. Head over to facebook.com. Type in Midnight Movie Cowboys. Hit the like button over there. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and find the links from there on the right-hand side. Thanks for listening. See you all next week.